This is The Women of Letters, a podcast dedicated to the TV show Supernatural and everything fandom. Another episode of the Women of Letters podcast, hosted by my wonderful self, Jules Wilkinson from the Super Wiki, and Amy here from Sweet Ondine, and just both from generally around fandom and the internet.
from around everywhere. Around, yes.
Just all over your social media. Yes. Where you least expect. So I don't have Snapchat.
Oh, I don't have Snapchat either. I think I've got most other things, but no. I did put Snapchat on my phone, but no one else I knew had it, so I was lonely and I didn't know what was happening. I didn't understand it.
In fact, I just deleted WhatsApp from my phone yesterday.
Oh, I use WhatsApp every single day.
Do you?
Yeah, I have people I talk to WhatsApp. Overseas people, I WhatsApp.
Oh, okay. I tend to use the Facebook Messenger probably or GChat, I think. For those.
Well, I use all of those as well.
Kids these days with our texting and our murder.
Wait a minute. How do you know about that?
Which ties into one of the episodes we're going to talk about this week. So we've got two episodes to talk about, Halt and Catch Fire and The Executioner's Song. But first up, a little bit of news from round the traps. Amy, why don't you tell us about a wonderful new T-shirt we can buy? I mean, Supernatural fandom is surfeit with wonderful T-shirts, but this one's a little bit special.
It's a little bit special. It's been produced by who Jules and I have just decided is Don Ackles, the head of the Supernatural family, sees himself as a godfather. He's produced a T-shirt, which the money will go towards charity. The profits after producing the T-shirt, I assume, will go towards charity. And it's got his lovely mug on it. wearing a tux and Supernatural family, and you can check his Twitter for it. It's one of the represent.com t-shirts, represent.com.
It's pretty
Jensen.
Easily, yes, represent.com /Jensen,
and you'll find it. And there's all different styles, so you know you've got your. I may have bought a couple of different styles because you know winter's coming, might need a hoodie. But there's like girly tees and boy tees and sweatshirts and hoodies. But he also, I noticed, added later, you know, like a larger sizes tees, because there was some commentary that, you know, all the tees were sort of on the small size. So there's
I think he realised there wasn't one there that would fit Jared.
Well, yeah,
that's obviously why he put on what's it called?
It's like
the all style big
short sleeve tee, but it goes to really great sizes. So I thought that was kind of awesome, actually. So big people can wear them,
I'll be
giant
buying,
tall people like Jared.
I will be buying, I think, one of the big short sleeve tees. But yes, very adorable. It comes with a quote on the page that said Jensen saying, "It's been 10 seasons together, which makes us all family. That inspired me to design my first ever T-shirt for you." And then he has a quote from the Godfather: "A man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man. Here's to the SPN family."
Bless.
And the design is actually based on an image from The Godfather of Don Corleone, and of course it's got SPN family underneath. So
hashtag SPN family,
hashtag,
because this is Jensen and he does love a hashtag.
So I do love the metaphor of, you know, all these mob families as a metaphor for fandom. I think that's, possibly very good. I don't know what I think about Jensen seeing himself as Don Corleone, a la a.k.a. Marlon Brando. There's layers upon layers of meta in there to untangle, I think.
Unless he's Godfather to Don. He could be Pacino.
No, but he quoted...
Well, that's
true.
He did quote Brando.
He did quote Brando. And the image is Brando. So
yes, it is.
No, he's he needs he to stuff some things in fabric. His cheeks. And we do have a propensity for killing each other occasionally, so
we do have a propensity for buying T-shirts, let's face it. Onto something there.
We do. So there's only 5 days left. He sold 4,700 so far. So let's see if we can get that over 5,000.
That would be lovely.
So we've had Mark Osric and Misha, of course, had his wonderful teas before Christmas. Jared, we're laying it down. Dude, we need a T-shirt. Obviously moose themed, I think.
I think it needs to be moose themed for sure.
Maybe you could go hats. But yes, get in and buy your T-shirt. What else have we got? The other thing you need to buy, our wonderful, wonderful writer, Robbie Thompson, who had a short story in a Spider-Verse anthology comic a couple of months ago, has hit the comic book stands with the first in his series of a new Marvel imprint called Silk. Just so exciting because, like, this is serious Marvel-verse shit. This is like this character could be in a Marvel movie. Bloody Peter Parker's in this comic. I mean, this is up there. So it's about Cindy Moon. Now, her story, if you're not into the Spider-Verse, is she was bitten by the same spider that bit Peter Parker. And then all this shit went down with the Inheritors and all the different spider people got together, and she ended up getting locked away in a bunker so that she was safe. Anyway, 10 years later, she's let out of the bunker. And this story picks up with her sort of back in the world. Her family's disappeared and, yeah, she's a young woman with superpowers. It is absolutely fantastic. It's got all the writing that we love from Robbie Thompson. It's funny. It's pop culture smart. There's meta in there. It's the first Marvel, if not the first superhero comic with a female Asian American as the lead. There's a female villain. There's a couple of queer women in there. It's funny. She's got heart. It's a bit sad. It's kick-ass. She has a great relationship a couple of times. There's a couple of scenes with Peter Parker, and she's going to intersect with other bits of the Marvelverse, including everything from Hydra to the Fantastic Four in coming issues. So do yourself the proverbial favour. I should say the artwork is by an artist called Stacey Lee, and it is just gorgeous. Cindy herself looks fantastic, and yeah, the art's just the sort of thing that it's jumps off the page, particularly the action sequences. But look, even if you're not a comic book reader, if you've never read a comic book, you know Robbie Thompson and you like his writing from Supernatural, you can buy this online. So you can get a digital copy through marvel.com, or there's a site called comixology.com. I think it's like $4 for a comic, and you can get that digitally, or of course you can go to your local comic book store and they will hand you a copy, and you can have it in your hot little hand and hopefully maybe get Robbie to sign it at some point.
Ooh, that would be nice.
It's so exciting, and I look forward to pop vinyl figures of Cindy. And like, yeah, she's just great. And she wears, like, instead of a full mask, she wears this, like, red scarf across her face. And, like, just the imagery is fantastic. But as I said, you know what Robbie's writing's like. It's got all the stuff we love from what we've seen in his work on Supernatural. So to be able to get that in another format is wonderful, and all power to him. I think he posted a picture of himself. He couldn't contain how amazing it was to walk into the comic shop he's been going to in Burbank for 15 years and buy his own comic.
Awesome.
It's a freaking Marvelverse, people. This is big stuff. So if you follow the Super Wiki, you know I've been spamming you with lots of articles and interviews, some great interviews with Robbie out there about how he's written it. Cindy is a feminist superhero, and just what the process has been like. So, as I said, do yourself a favour And let's see, two other projects by people from Supernatural. Ryan Curtis, who actually supervised the special effects for the first episode we're going to talk about this week. Ryan's usually the coordinator, which is like the second in command. He's directing a short film called Weirdo Hero, which is a wonderful concept. It's about a wrestler who is like sort of at the peak of his career and looks, you know, he's got a wonderful girlfriend, his career's going well, but he has depression. And so his life is falling apart behind the scenes. And his depression will be represented by this little animated creature. So the aim of the movie is to really destigmatize living with depression and also get out there that, you know, anyone can get depression.
It's
being filmed in Vancouver. There's an Indiegogo site at the moment to raise money for some of the stuff they need to pay for. Obviously, most of the crew working on it are volunteering, but they have to pay for, you know, locations and stuff like that. So Indiegogo, hit up Weirdo Hero. It's all on the front page of the wiki. A great project. Great to see Ryan getting to direct his first movie. And the other one is, a Finnish movie that finally, after years of waiting, hit our screens this week, is The Sidekick by Rob Benedict.
Yay!
Finally, we've been hearing about this for years and years and years. Well, not that long, but it was
a while.
It was made a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So you can get this on pay-per-view on Vimeo. It's about a 40 minutes, I want to say.
Yeah.
Film, maybe a bit longer, about a superhero sidekick who loses his job, starring Rob Benedict. Do I need to say more? It's absolutely hilarious and sort of sad and funny and all those things. Richard Spate's in it. There's a number of other familiar faces. And you should watch it. It costs you like $5 or something. It's nothing. Jordan Peele's in it, which, like, who knew Rob Benedict knew Jordan Peele? From Key and Peele. Well, that was my squee moment. It's like, so you do yourself a favour. It's a great little movie. In fact, I think would make a wonderful web series.
That's a really cool idea.
I think so. Because it's such a great character. And as Rob said, the idea is, you know, what happens? In a way, a bit of a metaphor for being an actor. I mean, what happens if you're a sidekick and you lose your job? I mean, what else can you do in the world? Like, it's a bit like as an actor. Like, you're not trained to do anything else except be an actor.
It's kind of like being a TV promo producer, I've got to say, as well. I often wonder, what the hell would I do if I hadn't got good for anything else?
Pretty sure you'd have some translatable job skills there, Amy. But maybe you could become a sidekick.
I think I'd make an awesome sidekick.
Anyway, so that's all the news. They're all linked on the front page of the Super Wiki if you want to catch up with of any of those things. Good things to entertain yourself with and support. So on to our two amazing episodes. Deep breath, Amy.
Deep breath. Yes.
Do you want to kick us off with Halt and Catch Fire?
Halt and Catch Fire. I thoroughly enjoyed this because I got really excited when I saw the promo pics for this, not just because they were kind of glorious, but also it was like, oh my God, is this like going to be like a salt and burn? Because it was, you know, pretty traditional, in a way traditional, but with a great sort of modern twist on a ghost hunt, which we haven't, we don't do them very often anymore. You know, the foes that the Winchesters fight these days are a lot more epic than just the spirits that they were once tracking down and, you know, salting and burning their bones. And so I got really excited with the fact that we were going back to, you know, what really we first saw the boys doing is, you know, a full-on traditional salt and burn, essentially, and it did have all the way through that very old school vibe, which was really enjoyable for me.
Yeah, so it was nice for them to be dealing with a ghost that wasn't one of their friends.
Well, that's true.
That was my first thought. Was although, of course, the whole thing brought up for me what's happening with Kevin.
Yes, and exactly.
So, even though they never mentioned Kevin, that's what I kept thinking was, oh, my God, Kevin's been dead at least this long, if not longer.
Well, exactly. He's been living with his mum for 24/7, so that's going to be making him even crankier.
Or, as someone pointed out to me on Twitter, she might be the one, you know,
holding him grounded
together.
Yes.
But, you know, I am worried.
I might have been channeling a little bit there.
Yeah, I am worried that.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, the ghost, Andrew, in this situation became a vengeful spirit. Now, obviously, he had something pretty full on to be vengeful for, in that he was killed in an accident, but that the people who caused the accident didn't in any way help him, and he was witness to that himself. They left him to die, yeah, and he was witness to that. He saw them, and, you know, his eyes were pleading with them for help, and they're just like, we're out of here, kids. But also, you've got to think that, you know, that what happened may not have happened if he hadn't have been stuck in the veil. You know, if he'd have actually gone on, he might not have hung around and become this angry spirit that he became. But he's, like, we assume everybody is still stuck in the veil. So he became a vengeful spirit, which made me do exactly the same thing. I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening to Kevin? Is he okay? Is his mum keeping him together? Is she locking him in his bedroom? No, you can't.
Of course, then
you
can. Yeah, I mean, it's it brings up those thoughts, and I hope at some point we'll find out what's happening.
Yeah, I do too.
Kevin. Kevin, I do miss you. Let's have a moment of silence for Kevin. But at least we still have Osric with us.
whose cosplay at PhoenixCon is amazing.
Oh, my God.
It made me tweet out, obey my dog.
Oh, dear.
It's amazing.
Seriously, the man is seriously cracked and seriously
and
talented.
And adorable. Totally adorable.
Anyway, back to Halt and Catch Fire.
Yes. And there was some... you know, like having the spirit as well, who was going after blood, and having the teenage girl who was just living and torturing herself with regret, was, you know, brought Dean Winchester very much into the picture of what he's had to go through and also what he's dealing with now, you know. So we had some really great conversations from him with the young girl whose name I can't remember. It's probably Emma. Sort of saying, you know, she's asking... Delilah, that's right. How could I
forget
that?
Who was actually played by Ali Milner, who, not coincidentally, because it's no coincidence to anyone except me, she's quite a well-known singer in Vancouver, and someone who I'd been put on to a couple of years ago, and you can look her up on YouTube. And so when I heard she'd been cast in this is only, I think, her second acting job, and I think she did an amazing job. But yes, very talented singer. You can look up as well, and local Vancouver woman. So there you go. As I said, coincidence to no one except me.
But it opened up for a really great conversation, I think, to have her and Dean in the room. And Dean was really empathetic in this episode, and to have him sort of talk about how he deals with or doesn't deal with.
Well, it was nice of him to be...
very open about it. I mean, this is the second time he's actually talked about how he's either a functioning alcoholic or, you know, like booze.
Well,
he just drinks to get rid of it.
As you and I have been talking about really all this season with both Sam and Dean and their both individual journeys and their relationship, I mean, you know, Dean's at a level of not only self-awareness but some sort of, I don't know what it is. It's the fact that he can talk about this sort of openly with someone, and he recognizes that he doesn't deal with things in the best possible way when he says, you know, whiskey denial, you know, I do my best to make things right, but you know, and you can't deal with things, you know, you can't just bury it, you've got to deal with it, which of course is not always what he does, but he is starting to, and we've seen that in his relationship with Sam this year, and I think importantly with himself, of being, of more confronting what he's feeling, or at least confronting the fact that he's not confronting what he's feeling. Like,
yeah.
There's a level of self-awareness there that he hasn't had in the past, I think. I mean, I think he always knew what he was doing, but he would never really admit it except in the most, sort of bitter moments of, you know, looking at it sideways. And you think back to the episode when he and Sam were in the psychiatric institute and he's hallucinating the psychiatrist, and he talks then about his, you know, lack of sleep and his drinking and everything.
Yeah.
But that was hardly a point where he was accepting it or recognizing that it wasn't a good, you know.
No, he was kind of going, this is how I live, whatever.
Yeah,
whereas,
yes.
You know, there is much more self-reflection in how he speaks about it now, and an acceptance in a way that it's not an acceptance, oh, this is just it, but an understanding of himself, I think, that we haven't seen in Dean before. And, yeah. And even just the fact that he could have that kind of conversation with a stranger, which he would never have done that, you know.
Yes.
I think he's in a much better briefly, he was in a much better emotional place. Just for a moment, for a split second there.
Well, let's go back to, we should really start then.
We should. So.
We're talking about Dean at the beginning of the episode. Oh, first of all, I do just want to mention the wonderful teaser, because as we're talking, you know, classic ghost, and we've got the possessed car, and it does that wonderful drive off the bridge
into
the title card, which is pretty fantastic. But, you know, we saw in the episode before this, you know, Dean basically had to be dragged out of his bedroom in the bunker where he was trying to research the mark. And, you know, the difference we start this episode with is where, you know, he's munching on a Krasuki,
which whatever Jensen had treated that photo of that.
Yes.
A while back.
Cross between a
cookie and a croissant.
Yes.
Which just sounds awesome. And he's right, you know. Sam's like, what is that, a cookie? No, who cares? It's awesome. It's like,
But, you know, we start this episode with him having found a case. So, you know, there's a progression between, you know, the last couple of episodes where he's sort of been on shutdown. You know, he's been trying to control his drinking and his eating. I mean, going back a few episodes now, in order to control the mark, he's been trying to control himself. Yeah, he's drinking, he's eating, he's and by the, you know, last episode, sort of literally shutting himself away in his room. Whereas we see a very obvious shift at the beginning of this episode, where he's, let's get a case, and, you know, I'm eating, yeah, and gets to college, and hey, there's lots of hot chicks around, and whether
that was just Dean. I mean, that was you can look at it and sort of go, was that Dean once again feeding the mark in the only way he knows how and keeping it into control? Because, you know, feeding like a craving that's burning, yeah, inside him. And so he's feeding it with this food and checking out the chicks. But then again, Dean's always liked chicks and food. So, you know, it's
I do think that's interesting, because I do think you can read it two ways. I actually read it as this was Dean feeling in control enough to sort of be himself, if you like.
Yes.
And then we see the things that are classic Dean things, and that he can feel he can open himself up to his own appetites, if you like, whether that's,
yeah,
food or sex. But I do also think that you, and maybe this is the point, you can't tell how much, and Dean can't tell how much is him and how much is the mark, because that's exactly the sort of behaviour we saw back when he first got the mark as well, with,
yeah,
the eating a lot and not sleeping. And so I don't know if the ambiguity is deliberate by the writers, but certainly that's how I read it, is that, you know, on the one hand, this is really Dean, and on the other hand, how much is the mark? And I think,
yeah,
that's what we keep seeing is, and they're playing with this theme of, you know, the mark. Does the mark unleash just what's inside you, or is the mark making you?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
which
that,
I think
that way, and I think that's
the most fascinating thing about the mark, is that, you know, like, you can look at it and say, well, the mark makes you this terrible creature, but is the mark just actually emphasizing a darkness that already, you know, lies within you? And I think that's something that Dean is very much mulling over and, aware of. And
remembering that Cain gave him the mark because, you know, he could see that Dean was a killer and worthy of, you know, the mark that the father of murder had. Mm. So, you know, I think there's that as well, which is part of the tension here is can you get rid of something that in a way is actually part of you? And that whole thing about, you know, Sam talking about to Dean about, you know, you're the one who can, you know, the power to control this is has to come from within you. So I think that's a really you know, interesting concepts to for us and for Dean to be thinking about in terms of his relationship to the mark. But anyway, they get to college and it's full of hot chicks.
I love seeing Dean check out the chicks. And a couple of them were checking him out too, which I thought was really great. He walked past a couple and they're like giving him the eyes. Well, because as you would if you're in college and you saw those boys sitting in your tuck shop, you'd be like, oh my gosh.
And just because it's a hot day here and I don't have much on, but I do have my ranty pants on. I'm going to have a little rant at some of fandom who were like, oh, that's creepy, Dean checking out college girls. What? Oh, well, fuck off. Like, what do you think the whole of fandom does to Jared and Jensen and Misha? Like, most of us are either 15 years older or 15 years younger than them or somewhere in between. And, like, the boy's got needs, the boy's got desires, and, of course, he's going to check out hot chicks. We do it. I mean, most of you check out hot guys, but I check out hot chicks. It's a funny little sort of prudish backlash that happens. And I know there are people for whom it's ship-motivated, like Dean shouldn't be checking anyone out except slash whoever you slash him with. But there's a broader sort of, oh my god, he's an old dude.
It's like, what? Old dude, my ass.
Yeah.
I personally love seeing Dean check out chicks. I think one of the hottest things about Dean is this kind of that kind of side to him where he's like, he checks the chicks out. He's a little bit casual about the encounters, and I personally think that's super hot. So for me, I'm like checking out the chicks. I'm like, woo, go Dino. I think I like it. Well, I'm obviously not British.
It was in line with, for whatever reason, but his appetites, both libidinous and for food. What's that? Hunger. All his hungers were heightened in this episode.
And it's also in line with more where he is personally as well. Like, it's where, you know, like if he'd have gone into a college in, you know, when he was in his darkest period in season 9, I doubt he would have been checking out the chicks. But, you know, he's in a better place emotionally, Mark or otherwise. He's in a better place. He's more Dean. As you say, he's more allowing himself to be Dean and not,
and
you know.
And both his appetite for both food and women is often used as a barometer for the state of Dean, if you like. So we saw, you can go back to season 2 and when he first meets Joe, you know, you can tell that there's sort of this moment, and then it's like, no, he's so full of grief around and guilt and everything around John's death and what he knows about Sam, is that that's just not an option in that moment. You know, something he would have normally pursued, you know, eagerly. And, you know, we see that again and again. There are long stretches, obviously, where you know, sex is the last thing on his mind. So it is sort of a barometer of where he's at. And then as we've said, the interesting thing this season is it's a barometer of him, but it also might be a barometer of the mark.
You're not really sure if it's Dean or the mark controlling it all.
And, you know, I think the main point in all of this is, damn it, Sammy needs to get laid. I'm concerned about the state of that pain of death. I tell you, I'm really, really worried. I mean, there's been no one since Amelia.
That we're aware of, unless he slips out at night when Dean's asleep and, you know.
Look, Amy, if I don't see it, I'm not interested in it, to be honest.
True. I need to see it as well, quite frankly.
Unfortunately, we know at this point the writers have actually finished writing the season. So if you haven't done it for this season, writers, please for next season, I'm going to start a hashtag get Sammy some.
Is that a petition or a postcard campaign?
It might be an online petition. I think we're past the post. We might get people to I think I've mentioned this before. I think it's a send in a condom campaign. Extra large for Sammy, of course. That will be starting. Anyway, sorry. My ranty pants took over for a moment there. But we get into this. We do have a very classic monster of the week, if you like, episode. We have that lovely moment about the apparently southern tradition of driving someone's truck to or car to honor them, which
I've never heard of that in my life. I was like, really?
Did you go and Google country songs?
No, I didn't, but is that a thing? Is that really a thing?
Well, I don't know. I'm from the south of Australia, not the south of the US. I don't know if it's a thing.
I was like, oh, is that a thing? Because when she, well, you know, of course, driving, I'm like, is that a thing? Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
But I also have...
I would be more like, oh, yay, I've got their car. You know, anyway, but...
I do have to put my ranty pants back on.
Oh, gosh. Jules.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
that's okay. I like your ranty pants. I always enjoy it.
Well, because a lot of people... Dean makes the comment when they're in the... I want to say the salvage yard because I'm thinking of Bobby. But when they're in the car yard and they're torching the car and Sam says, you know, if you died, would you come back and haunt my ass? And Dean's like, you know, you bet it if you stunk the car up with taquitos. And there are a lot of people going, oh, have they forgotten that Dean's already been dead a couple of times and Sam has driven the car? Well, the point is Dean's never been a ghost. He's never been in haunting mode.
No.
So the first time, the two times when Sam's driven the car, when Dean has been not of the in the living plane, was one time he was in hell and the other time he was in purgatory. So
people were upset about that. Yes, they were.
Like, oh, Lord.
Those ranty pants of yours are justified.
The writers
justifiable ranty pants.
The writers have forgotten that. Well, no, the writers know, as Sam does and Dean does, that he's never been a ghost.
So he has never been a ghost.
Never been able to be haunted, and so he couldn't say, hey, why didn't you haunt me those two times you were dead? Because, of course, they both know where he was, which was not in any state to be haunted. Haunting Sam.
Yes.
So there you go. If you're going to criticise canon, make sure you get yours right first.
Yes, Miss Wiki.
Other things I loved in this episode. Oh, look, we do have to pursue, I think, the intimation from Sam that Dean has Facebook.
Well, he did learn to poke, right?
Well, you can't do that if you don't have your own Facebook page.
That's pretty exciting. So I hadn't actually put those two together.
I feel that everyone missed over this big point, that it implies that both Sam and Dean have Facebook.
Oh, which is kind of cute. Who are those friends? Each other.
Well, or their other friends are dead.
I know. Maybe Charlie and each other, that's it.
Would Cass have Facebook?
Possibly, and I quite like the idea of Cass having Facebook.
I don't know how. I think Cass might be a step behind Dean in social media. I mean, he has struggled with basic phone technology. I did like the fact that Dean didn't know about the Nav app they were using, because, of course, I bet Dean has, like, just old
map. You know, well, they still
pay for maps.
It's not long ago that they were still getting maps out. Having maps in the front of the car. But anyway.
But I'm sure they use Google Maps a bit. But
I'm sure they use Google Maps.
I think Dean would feel insulted by having a voice tell him anything to do with driving.
And that voice gets so cranky with you when you go the wrong way. It's
And sometimes it gets taken over by a vengeful spirit and kills you.
Drives you off an empty, broken bridge, an unfinished bridge.
And I did like the little sort of stab at him for being a Gen X.
Christine.
Yes, I think that was very, very nice. And again, we do have, you know, you and I have talked about earlier this season and last season, though, you know, the boys have grown up. They're not in their early 20s anymore. They are now in their early 30s.
Dean's mid-30s.
Well, mid-30s. And it's nice to see that like, well, obviously you can see it, but it is reflected in the dialogue and the people that would have been, they would have been almost peers with, if you think back to Hookman, when, you know, yes, they could have almost blended in at college. They can't anymore. There's no way they can be a, you know, blend in. They have to be on the teaching staff side of things or be an FBI agent. But, you know, they're not, they can't do a 21 Jump Street.
No, they can't. But then again, Channing Tatum really probably couldn't either. But but that is a joke in the movie as well.
It certainly is. And, oh, now I'm just thinking of Channing Tatum doing a guest spot on Supernatural. Oh, I don't think I'm adverse to that.
I know I'm not adverse to that.
Maybe it'd have to be the Magic Mike is really magic episode.
Stop. I'm getting excited at the thought. Can someone write that, please? Thank you.
note to writers. You can have that one for free. We're happy to sign any disclaimers that we don't want any money from it.
Just please write him in there.
Magic Mike is, yes,
really magic.
I did like, again, we come back to, you know, Julie, who's been killed, and her, Sam finding her Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, InstaChat, Snapchat, AIM. But I love the fact that her posts are about Rush and 50 Shades of Grey. Like, because that's like a Supernatural fangirl, really. Like, it wasn't One Direction.
And yeah, yeah.
It was Rush and 50 Shades. So yeah. I thought that was, I thought that was a lovely touch, actually, because that felt like something that would be one of us would one of us would do. What else do we want to say about this episode? I suppose, because the monster of the week. I did love the way they did the face appearing on all the different screens.
I did too. I really liked the monster of the week. I thought it was really cool. I thought it was a cool idea that he got zapped into the Wi-Fi. You know, stuck in the veil, but got zapped into the Wi-Fi. So essentially, he was everywhere. You know, or could get everywhere, which I think was a nice twist on a horror trope that we've seen in, you know, Shocker and other movies like
Lawnmower
that kind
Man.
Of thing. Lawnmower Man, and the X-Files did that episode.
Yes.
Kill Switch, where it was like, you know, it was getting into all the machines. So,
yeah.
I liked that it was something different. It was in Wi-Fi. And I couldn't at first figure out what the speakers were, and then they were like, they're Wi-Fi speakers. I was like, oh, okay, right. I actually have those myself. Clever. They went really loud.
I felt like yelling out when it was like, is there anywhere the internet isn't? And I felt like yelling out, how? Probably is literally, it is in hell, but
probably,
you know, who would want to live
Crowley
somewhere?
Crowley probably has organised that.
He probably has the best reception ever, like an amazing download speed.
Oh my God. Yeah, that would be great. So I was the same. I thought the ghost was really great, and I really liked that the wife who we'd seen before in Wishful Thinking, she was the
very briefly
the woman in the showers who the, you know, thinks crazy, pushed her down the stairs. With the invisible guy. But I liked that the wife knew, you know, she knew that he was around and that she couldn't let him go and that they were having like an online relationship and it was like having her husband around, you know, because they were emailing each other essentially.
That's interesting. There's actually one of the episodes, I don't know if you've watched the series Black Mirror yet.
No.
You must. You will love it. It will disturb you deeply. But there's an episode in the second season that very much looks at sort of a different take, but it is about grief and about the premise is that there's a company that can reconstruct your loved one from all their online activity. Ooh. And basically produce an AI that it will be, you know, you can have an online relationship with, and it's based on all your emails and the person's presence on social media so that it can mimic, if you like, your loved one and takes
that's super
sort of
cool idea.
Well, but it's like
creepy.
Well, also, is that good for grief or not? And I think that was, you know, but again, and I think that touched on, you know, and I've over the years, you know, really loved how Supernatural's dealt with grief. And again, we have here this thing of that natural desire not not to want to lose someone.
Don't want to let go, yeah.
But then the downside of that, and I thought the fact that they could come to that, you know, the couple could come to that point where they both recognise that that's
not healthy, you know, for it's either
not,
of them.
Yeah, that it's not the good thing, and that, you know, unlike the Winchesters, who'll never do it, but, you know, sometimes love means letting go.
Yeah, they won't do it. Thank goodness, because that's what we love about them.
Well, I always think that, you know, at some point, and it doesn't have to mean that, that letting go means they're separated, but I think at some point, and, you know, that letting go has to happen in some way. But anyway, that's down the track. Maybe not as far down the track as we think. I thought the actor who played the wife was fantastic, and in fact, both the lead actors in that, Ali, who played Delilah as well. You know, they have to, those sort of roles in a supernatural episode like this carry a huge amount of the episode because they're the emotional heart of the episode, and if we don't buy into how they're feeling, then, you know, we don't feel about the episode, and any of the parallels with Sam and Dean don't resonate in the same way. And I thought, plus it often, you know, I often pity those poor guest actors who come in and then they have some long emotional monologue like both of them had. And I thought, yeah, that must be so hard to do, coming in cold, set you've never worked on. And, you know, you've got to give your all in that, you know, a speech that, you know, they both had speeches that really the emotional weight of the episode, you know, pivoted on, and that you can't have then the deep Sam and Dean moments if you haven't got sort of similar emotional depth across the whole episode, because otherwise it would ring hollow. So, yeah. You know, all power to them. I thought they did an excellent job.
Yeah. And then if we end with the fabulous scene between Sam and Dean in the car, with Dean saying that he can't go on living with this false hope, which, I mean, Dean's always been screw destiny right in the face, you know. He's always wanted to walk his own path, and I guess he doesn't want his destiny to be controlled by the mark. He wants to fight it and go down swinging if he has to, but he also doesn't want to get up every day hoping against hope that maybe there's a cure. He just wants to be able to live his life. And I thought it was so powerful that he said, you know, that his peace is in helping people, his yeah. peace is in the work that he does. And it's beautiful to actually hear him say that. I mean, you know, I guess we've heard him when he came back from hell, and it was in Monster Movie when he's talking to Jamie. He does say that, you know, like the experience in hell has made him sort of rethink his job, and that now he realizes he helps people and it's kind of awesome. But he's, you know, it's very up, and it ebbs and flows with Dean as to whether he thinks it's awesome or not, depending upon what's happening in his life at any given time.
Same with Sam.
And same with Sam. Exactly.
Back in, you know, again, as season two was, and I mean, all of this, of course, goes back to the whole, you know, family mission of saving people and hunting things, but. You know, that's what Dean said back in the second episode, is, you know, we're screwed, but at least we can help other people. And I think that's been the, you know, mission statement, if you like, of the whole show. But the character's relationship to that changes over time, of whether they believe that or not. And sometimes they're not sure who they should be saving and who they should be killing. And sometimes they're not sure if they're doing more good than harm.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like Sam in season two, it was sort of, you know, it becomes a desperate need to balance the ledger, you know, to balance out the harm they've done. It's like, I've got to save more people because I've done all this bad shit. So it's interesting Dean has, and I think Sam has too.
I think Sam has, yeah.
Place of peace. But of course, you know, Dean is still struggling with, you know, we've only recently, when he was saying that, you know, the difference between him being a hunter and a killer, and that's something he personally has gone back and forth on over time. And particularly we saw that in season seven when he was struggling with his six, when he was struggling with his life with Lisa, about, you know, is he a murderer and a killer, or is he a hunter? And I think he's got to the point of being a hunter, and then of course it all gets ripped away with the mark. So, you know, it's good that he's found this path sort of through having the mark at the moment, which is, yes, I'm going to do what I can do. He obviously feels a modicum of control over it at the moment. Yeah. So he's had a couple of hunts where, you know, he hasn't gone feral and psycho and killed everyone within, you know, a kilometre. So that's good. So he obviously feels some sense of internal control.
And I think also that there's like that unwavering faith that Sam has been putting in him, and Sam has been constantly reinforcing that Dean is powerful enough, that yes. Dean can stop this thing, that Dean can control it, that it's inside him, you know, and I think having someone that, you know, that looks up, that Dean knows looks up to him and has always adored Dean, and who is the most important person in Dean's life and always has been, you know, to have him constantly telling him, you're okay, you can do this, I have faith in you, I believe in you, I think that's really rubbed off on Dean. I think, you know, he's started to take that on board, you know, that maybe if Sam thinks that maybe there is a chance, maybe that is right, maybe I will give this a shot. I think a lot of Dean's new found at this point in time, his new sort of found peace and, you know, determination to go down fighting, and not to, you know, to try and live with it, to try and do what he does and live his life while living with this thing, which, you know, like, anyway, you know, I think a lot of what has brought Sam to the, Dean to this place is what Sam has been saying and the faith that Sam has put in him.
Mm. And we see, like, in Dean's final statement in the car, again, emphasizing this point of they've got to in their relationship, which is without rancor or not without them reacting. So Dean's not angry that Sam's upset that he thinks Dean's saying he's giving up, and Dean's careful to explain that he's not giving up, and that he says, I appreciate the effort. Yeah. I mean, this is so measured, and again, you know, Dean being able to say, you know, the answer's not out there, it's with me, which is, as you say, is exactly echoing what Sam's been saying, that Dean says he needs to be the one, you know, in charge of this. And got to know where he stands. And that, you know, that is such an open conversation for them both to have. And then, you know, we get that picked up, just now segueing into the next episode, when he says to Sam, you know, hey, you know, all that stuff I said, well, yeah. I didn't expect it was going to be next week.
I know.
And when he says, I'm scared.
Oh, my God.
I think also, I mean, both these episodes, but particularly Executioner's Song, so much of it is told just through the looks between Sam and Dean. And I think, interestingly, in that final scene in the car in Halt and Catch Fire, and a lot in Executioner's Song, but in that, Sam doesn't say things. So he doesn't rebut Dean. He doesn't keep arguing.
No.
You can see him listening. You can see his fierce, fierce love and wanting to support Dean, but also being aware of not shutting him down, not saying, no, you're wrong, we can do that. Like, he's not which is what people often do if you say, oh, I think this is really terrible. People go, no, no, it's not terrible. It's like, no, no, I feel it's terrible. Shut up and listen. And I think that's amazing that they've got to this point where, you know, Dean can say these things, but also Sam can hear them, and vice versa. So Dean's not hearing Sam as wanting to take control. Sam's not hearing, you know, he checks in with Dean. Is this about you just sacrificing yourself and, you know, giving up? But they can actually both hear what where the other person's at. And there's a lot of, you know, again, or kudos to the writers for recognizing that these actors can carry half the conversation by not saying anything.
Yeah.
And that gives it so much more weight, because we know Sam and Dean don't need to say everything to know what each other's thinking. And I think that's really given space, particularly in Executioner's Songs, the beats there of when Dean, you know, says, I'm scared. Sam doesn't say, well,
anything. You don't need to be scared. We're here for you, Jen. But that I think is also, as you say, I think it's you know, the writer's understanding that these brothers know each other so completely that Sam knows he doesn't need to say those words to Dean. And he also knows that he needs to give Dean the kind of space that is giving Dean now to find his way through it without pressuring him, without coddling him, without telling him he's wrong or trying to, you know, like being openly terrified for him. I mean, that we've, you know, he's actually giving his brother space to find his own way through it while supporting him and saying what needs to be said, but not saying too much. And I think
he also doesn't know what to say as well. I mean, it is one of those situations where
there's been times though. I think I think the end scene in that car was one of the times where you could tell, like, Sam was going, I'm just going to let that one slide. He can believe what he thinks here. But Sam's face was like, I am finding a cure for this damn mark, no matter what. That last face of Sam was like, yeah, okay, Dean, he's not saying it, you know. And I think that's really great. He's allowing his brother to have that moment of strength without undermining him and sort of going, I'm still going to do it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, so much of their story in the last couple of seasons has been about, you know, learning about giving the other person, acknowledging their reality and letting them know, not saying this is what you should have and this is not what you should do or this is what's right for you or me. And I think, you know, they've both got to a place with that. And I think, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds because, of course, we know, you know, as much as they've learnt over the years, for either of them, it's an incredibly difficult position to feel helpless when their brother is threatened.
Yeah.
And
they want to do whatever they can to save them.
Yeah, and look, you know, we've seen Sam reacting in wildly different ways when Dean went to hell. Of course, he led him to desperate things, and when Dean came back from hell, Sam still carried so much of that guilt for failing Dean. That's what led him to everything he did with Ruby. And then, you know, then we had his different reaction when Dean went to purgatory, where Sam just gave up. Then we had when Dean disappeared at the end of last season, and again Sam was ready to do anything to find out what had happened to Dean, having, you know, learnt that's, you know, what he wanted to do. But it's hard for them both, and I think they're both handling it really well at the moment, as well as you can when you have this sort of shit going down. Because Dr. Phil, I haven't done an episode on this.
No. But I think they're handling it really well. I'm really proud of them.
So heading into the next episode, the Executioner's Song. Ominous drum roll.
My God, and it was so wonderful. It was so wonderful and so painful, but wonderful, and all those supernatural feels that it does. That oh my God, this hurts so much. It's amazing.
I have to say this. I'm not going to claim favorite episodes of the season so far because it's a bit of a hard call at this point. But my God, was this everything supernatural does brilliantly?
It was supernatural. It was the essence of supernatural, this episode, I thought.
And everyone bought their A game. I mean, like, from Phil Segrisha's directing, right by Bob Behrens, all the amazing sets by Jerick Wanick and the crew, from, you know, from hell to the barn at the end, and of course, the bunker. That scene between Kane and Cass.
Oh, it was beautiful. Babes.
I mean, that was just
so rare. Many of the, it was, and there were so many scenes in this that were just the scope of them. So the whole episode felt incredibly cinematic because the scope of so many of the shots. I mean, the hallway as Kane walked down with the lights, and it was really
that beautiful,
a really long hallway. And then again in hell as a really long hallway, or wherever Crowley is, hell adjacent his crib, a really long hallway with Rowena and him walking down it. So there were so many really such large shots, and of course the grave shot, that it just felt so big, this episode. And it really did more. I mean, I always think that Supernatural feels like a little movie every week. I mean, it's a road show, so we never get that apart from the bunker, which is so stunning that, you know, it doesn't just feel like a set. You know, we don't have that kind of enclosed set feel. So it really does feel like a little movie every week. It's so beautifully, the cinematography is always so beautiful. Serge does. This was stunning. The lighting in the barn was just so incredible.
Well, and as you said, the opening, just to take it, if you go back and watch that opening sequence in the prison, you've got that incredible editing of the sound, like as he's walking along between the music and the guard banging and banging the door with his nightstick. And then when that's echoed with Kane walking down and the sizzle of electricity as his hand touches the metal. I mean, that in itself was just...
This was
just
a beautifully
amazing.
Edited episode. There was a couple of places in it where I went, oh, my gosh, that... Well, you know, like not on the first watch, but I've watched this maybe 7 times, I would hesitate to say. It's quite a lot, even for me, because I just really loved it. And every time I see it, you know, like even beyond the story and the performances and the writing, it's just such a visual feast that I'm just enjoying watching it and seeing something new in every scene. And, you know, there was even just at the end when we cut from Dean pulling out the blade to Dean walking down the stairs, there's a beautiful edit there that it's just, you don't see it, but there's this wonderful sound design of the sound of the blade coming out, and then, you know, it dips to black, but we open up on Dean's back, which is full frame, on, you know, as he walks down the stairs. So there's this lovely transition, and it was just such a... No, sorry. Editor sitting here. it was just such a beautiful transition. I was just like, oh my God, that was really gorgeous. I think this episode was, as you say, everybody brought their A game. It was stunning in every regard.
Yep. And on top of that, like, just such an incredibly emotional episode. Mm. Obviously, and you know, again, as we've already talked about, you know, the acting just, you know, kicked that out of the park. And you know, where do we start? Where do you want to start with talking
about? I don't know.
It's like, it's really hard to. The boys arriving at the prison. I love.
Shot.
Yeah.
It's like I was sitting in the back with them listening to them.
And then it was actually Phil Segrisha's voice.
I know, yeah.
As they drive in, which was just that really bored sounding voice.
But I really, like, I adored that opening shot of the guys, and just, you know, they were driving, Jensen's driving down the road, and we're in the back seat, and it really did feel like you were just kind of listening in on them, their silly conversations that they must have in the car all the time, and their hours and hours that they drive on the road, you know, and Dean teasing Sam, and Sam not biting, which I thought was really good, and of course Sam's going to be into serial killer stuff, what? Ever. But it was just the whole setup of that scene, and it was really representative too, I think, of the brothers and where they are now, that they can drive along and have these ridiculous bickering conversations that they have that are fun, you know, and teasing, and you know, it's like Sam goes, I think it's in our wheelhouse, and Dean's like, your wheelhouse, you know, crazy person. And it was just gorgeous. It was a beautiful shot. I don't think we've ever had the total back seat. I mean,
yes, we have.
Which one was it?
Oh, look, I'll have to look it up. I'm sorry.
I know, but there was. I remembered that in the Dragon episode, Like a Virgin, we were in the car with them, and I think that actually was a Phil Segrisha shot as well. And there was that great track on the radio. I can't think what it was, but. And we were in the car in the back, but we weren't like right at the back. So we were kind of more in the middle of them, in behind them, but in the middle of them. So we were getting to see more of their faces. But I just couldn't remember ever being completely in the back seat where we only got the back of their heads and Dean in the rearview mirror.
Pretty sure we've only had it once or twice before, but I will do some research.
Yeah. It was beautiful. I loved it. It is now my... header on my Facebook page, by the way.
I noticed that.
Because I was like, oh my God, I'm in the car with them.
And then, of course, just jumping ahead, we get, another little shout out. You know, so we have the Guanaco food truck, which is owned by the family of Jose Manzano, one of the camera operators. So that's
delicious.
Always good. and it's delicious if you're ever in Vancouver. But then to that scene with Cass and Kane, and I mean, seriously, Timothy Odmundson, what can you say?
Amazing. He just, that character, Kane is, you know, like, it's hard for me to even think that he's only been in two episodes. Like, he's just such a big character. He feels such a part of the myth arc of this show. You know, like, it feels like he's always been a part. And, I mean, I know that we've referenced Cain and Abel, and Michael said to Dean back in season five about, you know, that it's in their blood, Cain and Abel. You know, it's always been there, that they descendant from Cain and Abel, they go back. Yeah. So, I mean, it's been part of the mythology that, you know, we sort of, when we found out what Sam and Dean's roles were, it's been part of the mythology. But that character is so huge. Tim Amundsen has just kind of made him so big that he just feels like he's always been there. And he's fabulous, amazing looking. It just looks, with the hair and the piercing blue eyes. I mean, he's perfect, because you'd want that character to have, like, an astonishing presence. And Tim Amundsen just has an astonishing presence with him.
He is. And, you know, it is a role that needs a big presence. I mean, this is the father of murder. That's like...
the firstborn child.
This is a big title to give anyone. And... you know, he carries it so wonderfully, but just I don't know. I think there's a unanimous response from everyone of just how that was an inspired piece of casting.
Unbelievable.
And he just owns every scene. But, you know,
and his gallivant hair just added to it. Like, I had forgotten that his hair was short in Firstborn, the first episode that he was in. Yeah. And I actually watched that before this episode, so I could, you know, catch up on Kane. I was like, oh my God, Tim's hair's so short. because I'd got used to him with this crazy, wild, flowing locks. And it works. I think it works. Oh, it just made him feel even more huge, you know. And you know, it's so tragic. Like, in that, I love that... when it's Cass is talking on the phone and he knew that Cain arrived because there's just like this weird breeze or something, and he's like, you know, I gotta go. And it's like, he just, you know, sensed him. And I always really love these scenes where we get like two characters like this. We've got the, you know, the firstborn child and an ancient angel who's, you know, whose father is basically the reason that this, who is the creator of this guy's parents, you know, the first people. And it felt so massive to have them in that scene together, but so far apart. And it was just wonderful.
It was. And I mean, you never doubt Cain's power. And I mean, I think that's with any of these strong characters or big characters, and whether it's Abaddon or Metatron or Lucifer, you have to believe, that they're powerful. And you obviously, we have to get that through their acting, their personality, and you don't doubt for a moment that, you know, we've not had it spelled out exactly what Kane's powers are, because we don't need to, because dude, you know, he's... And so that's frightening, and in the middle of that, you know, incredible graveyard, and just knowing the fact that, you know, he could take Cass out, you know, with a snap.
But he's not on the list.
He's not on the list.
But I really loved, you know, that he was like, Cass is like, this is a massacre, which is going to become genocide. But I felt so sad that Cain had fallen off the wagon, you know. But on the flip side, he was feeding the mark, the blood, but he was also rectifying what he believed was a great wrong that he started.
Well, again, it's that, you know, trying to right your wrongs. Yeah. Do you know... It's all in your own perspective. He thinks he's doing
the
right thing
by killing like one-tenth of the people on Earth.
Yeah.
It's probably a little bit excessive.
And, of course, the intimation that, you know, Dean's certainly on that list, and his interest when he finds out that, you know, Dean's been really, you know, taken over by the mark as well.
Because at first he's like almost with pride, I hear Dean did good, you know, and there was like...
Yeah, he killed Abaddon, what Dean wanted.
There was a bit of pride in his voice, and then it's like, well, he's not doing good, you know, and, yeah, it piqued his interest.
So just to touch on the sort of Crowley-Rowena subplot here, which we can finally seen by the end of this episode, you know, the path that's been running on, and I think the path of where, you know, Crowley's relationship to the boys is obviously by the end of this episode when he's been sort of screwed over by Dean, basically. He's not Moose's. Has really, you know, let him know that he's not his bestie anymore.
He's just that demon that he always was now.
Just being used.
Yeah.
The way
the Winchesters have always done that.
Yep. And, you know, we can see, and obviously I think you were talking last time we spoke about, you know, whether he knew what Rowena was doing or not. And so obviously he does, but I think, you know, as often happens, her agenda and his possibly will end up aligning, you know, even though they're sort of split at the end of the episode, you know, it's her reaction that's going to perhaps motivate him into open antagonism against the Winchesters.
And I think regardless of whether he knows that she's a conniving witch, which he obviously knows, and he did actually sort of say, look, did you think you were fooling me? She's still his mother who deserted him, and you can see that there's still this need in him to, he almost wants to, I think he wants to believe her. It's almost like he wants to have her approval, even through that whole little bit while she was suggesting what he did to that demon who was, you know, whatever he was doing, wanting more money or something. And she was like wanted to rip him apart, and Crowley went, I think we'll do that. You know, there was an element there where it was like, you know, as much as he's looking at her going, I know what you're doing, it's still the mother that deserted him who's now back. And the conflicting emotions that is obviously raising, I think, is being played really beautifully, because he seems to want her approval while he's, you know, dissing her. You know, and I think that's a really great representation of, you know, how some people's relationship with their parents winds up.
And also, you've got to remember, I think, as King of Hell, he has no one around him to, you know, as the Romans used to do, have someone whisper in his ear to stop him believing in, you know, his own legend, if you like. And so she's telling him some, whatever her motivation is, so certainly in the final scene, some home truths about, you know, you're fucking not being a good king of hell at the moment. I mean, you battled for centuries or whatever to get to be king of hell, and now you are, what the fuck are you doing? You know, you're not being the king of hell. And I think that realization is, you know, as much as whether it comes from Rowena or not, no one else is in the position to tell him that. And, you know, I think that's the thing that's going to drive him to be like, well, you know, obviously doing whatever I do ain't going to make me besties. And I'm sure he doesn't in his head think, I want to be besties with the Winchester. I think that's a subconscious thing. But suddenly realizing he has to do his own shit, and he has to get his own shit together. Whatever that is for him, and that he's really sort of betwixt and between at the moment. And I think this is that, and Dean's actions are going to be the things that set him on the path to open antagonism with the Winchesters.
Yeah, I think Rowena was. I had wondered what her role was, and I think this episode showed, you know, how pivotal she's going to be to turning Crowley back into what he should be, really.
Exactly. Well, and she's certainly I think as we saw with that she gave him the spell for the glamouring spell that they used to trick Cain with the young child, she's useful as well.
Yes.
You know, she's got game, this woman.
And
it'll be
interesting. She wears a fabulous cape.
Oh, God, she looks...
Hey, when she's swishing that cape at the end, I was like, oh, my God, she's got like a big long black cape on. It looks like it's velvet. That's the best thing ever.
Seriously, what a delight to be able to dress and have her, because she's...
Even her luggage.
Oh,
it's like old carpet bags. Oh, my God.
And Ruth Cannell, the actress, actually posted a picture of that chair that she was sitting on when they were in the court, that they had to put it on bricks because she's so short.
Tiny.
But I did. It was one of those times in this episode where you think she's shorter than Mark, and then we have a shot when Crowley and Sam are standing next to each other near the barn, and you're suddenly like, oh my God, Sam, you are
giant.
Godzilla. Like, you really are.
He's so tall.
Huge. Like, you know, Mark Shepherd is not a short man.
No, but he did. Like, when he stepped up next to Sam, it was like, I actually commented on that too. I'm like, look at the height difference. And you just, I don't know, you don't notice it normally quite that much, and you don't often see Mike standing right next to Jared. But, yeah, he's not a short man. But Jared's just stupidly tall.
Yes. But it also, it always reminds me of the, you know, the technical challenges of framing things where you have people of vastly different heights.
That's and why
you,
Sam's you know, sitting a lot.
Exactly. you know, and seriously, it must be such a challenge to and it's easier, obviously, when you're in close up, you can sort of squib a bit more and you know, have them standing on the proverbial apple box. But as soon as you have a wide shot, all is revealed. as the saying goes, that's one hell of a height difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is actually the tagline for the Sam Gabriel pairing.
Oh, really?
Yes. I've always loved that. That's one hell of a height difference. Anyway, where do we go back to? Let's go back to them arriving at the tracking down the child arriving at the farm and actually managing to you know, come up with a plan. And then we have, as we alluded to before, that conversation where Dean's like, yeah, I didn't think going down swinging was going to be – And again, that's a moment of and it's interesting that Kane brings it up about Dean's bravado.
Yeah.
And the funny thing being that we've seen the same amount of courage, but maybe less of that bravado, which I always think of bravado as being sort of a false front.
Courage, yeah.
And the fact that he doesn't say, yep, okay, well, turns out today's the day, the fact that he can admit to Sam. Of course, poor Sam is like, you know, I appreciate the honesty, Dean, but maybe like
– hold that back because I'm really scared too.
Yeah, exactly. And telling Sam now he can't do anything. And
no one can do anything because the only one who can wield the blade is Dean. And so, you know, no one can do a damn thing, which makes the whole thing even more tragic. But, yeah, it was like, I felt a bit bad. I thought Sam was like, oh, my God, like he didn't say anything. But I thought, for me, Sam's face was like, oh, shush. Shush, I'm just holding on here. Please don't tell me that.
Well, also, and I'm sure, though, his brain's running at a million miles an hour of what can we do in this position.
Yeah.
And then, and we have, as they keep emphasising in this is not just about can – Dean kill Kane, it's what will Kane do to Dean.
Yeah.
And so it's almost a no-win situation because they're all aware that feeding the mark and feeding it in this way is going to affect Dean.
It's putting that blade back in his hand will just, you know, could push him right over the edge.
And so
because really with the mark last time, that's when Dean started really – it was starting to affect him, but it wasn't until that blade got into his hand that he really started to change.
And we've seen this season what he's done without the blade. So,
that
heightened all that tension. I have to say, aside from it being wonderful to have Team Free Will back together this episode, it was also great to have the four of them. Like
Team Free Will were standing there chatting and then Crowley piped up, oh, I can't believe it either, and you know, his shoes and his suit sort of sort of came out of the blackness, out came Crowley. I squeed because I was just like, oh my God, it's all four of them together. It's been so long. And I just thought, what a day.
A very rare event.
Very rare. And what a day on set that I thought that must have been such a great day to have all four of them on set at once.
Possibly crazy day.
It would have been crazy busy day, I think, to have all four of your leads on set. But it would have been so fun and they would have been having a blast, I reckon. So
yes. So someone was tweeting me about how emotional some of that must have been, and I'm like, oh no, no, those four on set, it was possibly crazy cakes hilarious.
I reckon it would have been so fun. I was the same. I was like, oh my gosh, all four of them in a scene having conversation, even though the line was totally drawn, I really like that for straight up from when Crowley came in and said, you know, I'm worried about what it does to us, and Dean's like, there is no us.
Oh, yeah.
And that line was drawn straight away. Crowley's over there on one side and Team Free Will are on the other side, and that straight from the get-go, you could, you know, he was an outsider, he was there for one purpose and one purpose only. But it was awesome. Yeah, I was the same. I was like, oh my God, it's all four of them. That's so cool. Yeah, it was gorgeous. And the lead up to Dean going into the barn finally to face Kane, all those looks, oh my gosh, you know, like it was very, someone said to me, like when he walked up the stairs and he turned back and smiled at Sam, and you know, it was for Sam, it was very point of no return, you know, with that little kind of smile. But there were, you know, there were other looks just there, when there was just so little being said and so much being said in those moments. It was really wonderful.
And then we have the confrontation between Kane and Dean, which, oh my God, from the emotional content to the actual awesomeness and epicness of that fight.
And how it was shot, like there were some beautiful camera angles that it felt almost intimate, like you were getting right in there, those really kind of crazy angled stuff when Dean was on the ground. And
it reminded me of the fight between Dean and Cole back in the second episode, where it almost one. Is...
like a ballet.
Yeah, it's almost like a dance because they're so mismatched, and it felt like that with, you know, with Kane and Dean, that he's really just pirouetting to get out of the way, and then, and then he charges Dean with the fact that, you know, Dean's really holding back, he's not letting the mark, power him, and then you have Dean getting thrown through fucking window and wall,
and you know, that all that glass in it, that I love the photo that Sabrina treated with Jensen with all the makeup and the glass all embedded in his face. It looked amazing.
I have to say, there's been a couple of times this season, you know, when Dean's got particularly bashed up, that, you know, the makeup have done just such an awesome job. And when you think, again, and not that we always want to, you know, pull back the curtain and ruin the magic or that, but just when you think of the coordination that has to go on, you're doing a fight scene like that, which is, you know, highly choreographed, and there's stunt people involved, and you've got big things like that wall having to, whatever had to be done to make that work, and the glass and everything, then you've got all the continuity with tiny bits of glass on someone's face.
Yeah.
I'm always, and obviously there's special, both special effects and visual effects have to be involved and all that, and you just say, oh my God.
It's a really big scene.
It's a huge scene, and you know, I hope maybe at the Phoenix convention this weekend we can hear a bit more about, you know, what it took to film that, because you know, it was so incredible. It was just so, it was so intense.
It was intense.
You didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, I certainly didn't think Dean winning was assured.
I didn't think he was going to do a Star Wars and hack off Kane's hand.
Yes, a lot of people noticed the similarity between the whole conversation.
The sun and, you know,
The epic Empire Strikes Back Darth Luke conversation, where it's basically, together we can rule the galaxy.
Yeah. Give over to the dark side.
Come sun. To the dark. Yes. Well, it is.
And then hacks off the hand. I'm like, oh my God.
Kane's, you know, statement that, you know, Dean is living his life backwards, and that really chilling description he gives of, you know, first you'll kill Crowley, and oh, that'll give you some mixed feelings.
Yeah.
And
oh, that was that made me. I was like, yep.
And then you'd kill Cass, and you'd That's be devastated.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then you'll come to the murder you'd never survive when you finally turn on your brother. And it's like, oh.
And you know, which is a spectre that Dean had living over his head since John whispered in his ear at the beginning of season two that one day he was going to have to kill his brother. But the thing that Dean has done that Kane didn't do is that he's always believed in Sam, and he's always had faith that Sam will triumph over whatever supernatural adversary he's...
Yes!
I mean, he has. He never believed that... He had a gun in his hand in season two. He never believed that Sam would go dark side and that he'd have to do it.
Ah, but... At the end of season four, when he's got Sam locked in the panic room, he's prepared to let him die. Like, he doesn't think he can resist, that he thinks that he's given over to the demon blood and that he'd rather Sam die than become a monster.
But
so,
he's asking for help there. He's not actually given up hope, because he actually does go outside and ask for help, anything at all to help him through. He never gives up hope, and he didn't give up hope at the end of season five. Mm-hmm. He believed in Sam that he could triumph over Lucifer. And
certainly by the end of season five.
And I think that's the difference. Kane didn't believe in his brother.
Yeah, I'll buy that. Yeah.
I mean, so I was yelling at Kane, no! You've got it about your chops, around your chops.
We don't know anything about Abel. And
no, we don't.
We know a lot about Sam Winchester.
We do.
And
also the mark was transferred onto Dean. It was transferred onto Dean. He didn't get it as like a punishment for a crime.
No.
But we don't know
if that matters or not.
We don't, but it might, you know, like, but to me, like, not in the first episode, because the first time I watched it, I was just like, wow, shut up, I'm crying and everything. But by the second one, I'm like, shut up, Kane, you're so wrong.
Well,
and
I don't know.
And you're not Dean Winchester anyway.
Sure. However, it seemed... very heavy, well, portentous is probably the word rather than foreshadowing. And I, for one, would not be surprised if some of it doesn't play out.
No, I don't think. I think my thing was, is this where we were going all along? Oh, my God. It's like we've gone back to, you know, where we started with the brothers and, you know, this kind of spectre hanging over. And, yeah, like, I'm with you. I thought it was not foreshadowing as such, but...
But it could be.
Lingering. Yeah, it could be.
I am prepared to accept that if maybe later in this season Dean kills Crowley.
We've discussed this. I think it's a... I don't know if it'll be this season or... it's going to happen.
And then I don't think he would kill Cass, but maybe that could be a turning point of something between them. I don't think he would kill Cass, but maybe that's the point at which there's some intervention. Or he will kill Cass, and then we'll get to the point of him being at the point of killing Sam. I don't know. Supernatural. They hate our hearts.
I know, but a lot they do hate our hearts. But, you know, I was like scrambling for reasons why it wouldn't happen and can't happen. Because it can't happen. Dean's never going to kill Sam, at least not forever. Or not out of anger if it, you know, like if anything like that happened. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Do you hear me? My God, it's not going to happen. But yeah, I was like going, oh, come on. It's all sort of different. But I do actually believe that the one thing that Dean has, and I mean, Charlie said it as well, you know, Kane doesn't have what you had. And I think the one thing that Dean has that Kane didn't have, for whatever reason, is this relationship with his brother that is fueled much more on belief in him and belief in his strength to overcome. And yeah. I think that's a difference. And I think it's an important difference. And I actually think it might be the important difference.
Well, yeah, I suppose it depends what could lead up to them being in that situation. So, I mean, I think we've got it quite obviously set up of how Dean and Crowley could come to, you know, be in direct conflict. Obviously, you know, we're a long way from that with either Cass or Sam. So, you know, maybe whatever happens with Crowley might be the tipping point. Maybe. Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? But certainly Sam's scared.
That final scene in the kitchen, which had everything from both, you know, this gorgeous domestic intimate moment and Sam, you know, reaffirming, you know, how strong Dean's been and Dean's smile and then the sort of, you know, nonchalant, oh, well, you know, fake yawn, I'm off to bed. Well, it's probably a real yawn, but I'm off to bed. But then those moments, which I've seen many GIFs and caps of how both Dean's face, if you watch Dean's face, just after he's clapped clapped Sam on the Cass on the shoulder, and his face drops and changes.
Oh, it goes so dark.
And then it pans out to see Sam's face change.
Yeah.
And his, you know, oh.
Cass, Dean's in trouble.
Dean's in trouble.
And by then I was sobbing.
And then, and it's got a variation on the you know, Winchester Family theme playing,
yeah.
Which, you know, I only need two notes of that to
tip me over the edge. I was like, God, this, I have howled a lot in this season. I reckon this season has been my teariest year. I seriously do. I have been like super big sobs. Sometimes they've been happy ones, but. Like when Dean hung the amulet in the Impala, wah, you know, but most of the time it's just been like, oh, I can't stand it, sobs. And yeah, this has been a very teary season for me, but yeah, I burst into tears again in this one. It was very sad. And for Sam, I love that he could see straight through Dean and knew straight away that what Dean was doing, but he just looked so scared. I'm really glad he's got Cass.
Yes. So, God, it'll be interesting to see where we pick up. We come back
in 4 weeks.
We come back on the 18th of March on a Wednesday night. So we're back to Wednesdays after Arrow, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah, it's great.
We're moving because the new series iZombie will be following The Flash on Tuesdays.
Which I watched yesterday, 4 episodes
of. Oh, and?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was cute and kind of a bit of a zombie Veronica Marsy kind of vibe.
Wonderful.
It sounds sassy and she's cool, sassy. It's procedural, you know, fun cases, but there's like a zombie myth arc through it and it's funny, you know, what she has to do to get by and sassy dialogue. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I look forward to that. Mm. And, so we have to wait. There will be another couple of little breaks this season, as we've said before. They need these breaks so that the season ends up at sweeps week in May, and also because, like, as far as I know, they were only just finishing work on episode 15 now, so it would be rather hard for it to get, you know, they're starting to run into, so they actually need time to be able to finish making the episodes before we can see it. I know it's frustrating, but I'd always rather have the season go on longer because it's
me too.
Yes, it's nice to have it, you know, longer over the year rather than shorter.
Yes, I agree. It's nice. As much as I went, oh my God. Because, I mean, this one felt like, you know, like a mid-season cliffhanger, you know, and then we're going into, would they have known that there was a 4-week hiatus after this one when they prepped it? So, yeah. So that's why, I guess, because it was just like, oh my gosh, leaving us on that note.
They particularly planned the ending to be like that, but I'm sure that they planned,
because it felt very cliffhangery for, you know, like going into a hiatus after that ending.
Yes. And I'm sure they planned it as, yeah, a big myth arc episode, but yeah. probably didn't sit down and go, we definitely need a cliffhanger. But it turned out that way.
Yeah. It was a wonderful episode. Unlike you, I will pick it as, so far, my favourite episode of the season.
But there's fan fiction and then
fan fiction. I kind of sit fan fiction out until it's a different little bubble for me than the rest of them.
Yes.
But I just thought this was magnificent. And I think, you know, like having the four of the characters in and all working together, and it really added to it. And Kane was amazing, but it just looked fabulous. And the performances were just remarkable. You know, Jensen Ackles is just, I mean, you know how I feel about him, but it's just insane. He's insane emotion.
The scene with him and Odmundson, I mean, that's
breathtaking.
Like a masterclass in acting. I mean, you can both just
of them.
Really incredible. It really was.
And the, you know, him pleading for Kane to tell him that he would stop, that he could stop, because that means there's hope for himself if he could. But it just the anguish on his face and yeah, oh gosh, such a good episode and beautiful script and the whole thing. Wow, it's awesome.
The whole thing was amazing. And yeah, I think and that's not even, I mean, usually it's six these days with the longer season, it's usually episode 16 or 17 that are the really big myth arc episodes, so God knows what that's
Help.
Gonna be.
Help! Oh my gosh. Yeah, awesome. So we will be, well, I don't know what we'll be doing next.
We'll be in Vegas.
So I will be. I head to Vegas in 2 weeks, and VegasCon is in 3 weeks. But I'll be in LA for a few days before heading over to Vegas.
We might do a Vegas podcast when you get back, because I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about.
We'll definitely do that.
Is that the week you get back before the next episode
No,
airs?
I get back on the day the next episode airs.
I don't know if that's well worked out or not. But so anyway, we can talk a bit. We'll talk about VegasCon and the next episode in the next podcast.
Yeah. That sounds great. So we're on a little hiatus too, by the sounds.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Yes, I've got to go and do something with that wiki thing. Thank you for listening, everyone. Oh, one thing, though. I'll need your adjudication on this as well, Amy. And we didn't talk about this. I can't believe we didn't talk about this. The scene after Dean comes out when he falls into Sam's arms.
Oh, yes. Is this a hug or a not hug? Is this what
you're
asking?
Well, let's just go amazing. Like that whole scene. Silently hands the blade to
Cats. It was
Cats.
Beautiful. And he's standing upright. I mean, and of course he handed it to Cass. You know, like, was a powerful thing in itself, because he knows that Cass will remove it from him, protect it, and not allow Dean to get it no matter what. But he's also handed it to the person that he's asked to kill him in the event that he needs to be killed.
Exactly. As well as it being, you know, a slight
on Crowley.
You know, Crowley expecting it.
And I really liked how Cass stepped away from Crowley and came and stood beside Dean.
Yes.
So
yes,
it was a real separation.
Team free will, baby.
Yeah.
But then when he just collapses in Sam's arms.
I can't believe we didn't talk about this either. The hell?
Don't worry, I wasn't letting us going to go with, because it was just such, whether it's a hug or not, and I was concerned
with the
definitions, because it, like Sam holding Dean at the end of season 9, I mean, I sort of, you know, there's difference between holding someone because they're dead
that wasn't a hug.
But, you know.
Might have been huggy, though.
Well, I don't know. I think
he was holding Dean up.
You know,
I think there was hug intention from Sam. I think Dean was just needing someone to hold him.
Well, but I think he needed a hug too.
He needed a hug, but I think he was just
to
like
fall
he
into
was
the hug.
Yeah, he fell into the hug, but Sam was already moving forward before Dean started to fall. I think, you know, Dean, like, he came out, you know, I've done this thing. I've got rid of the blade. I've pissed Crowley off. Oh God, I can just drop it all now. And it was, and I mean, really, he couldn't drop it all until Crowley was zapped away. He wouldn't want Crowley to see any of that, but he can reveal that to Sam, and he can reveal that to Cass, and you know. But just falling into Sam's arms was just like, oh my God, oh my God, this show is going to kill me one day.
We're already dead.
We are
already
over and over. We're like Supernatural. We keep dying and coming back.
I did have to say, though, I mean, just pulling the – they're not really ranty pants. I'm over that now. wow, they're slightly ranty pants.
Put one leg on.
There was a bit of argument in certain parts of fandom over who Dean loves the most. And, you know, the Destiel fans were going, oh, it was such a Destiel episode. And the Wincest fans were going, oh, such a Wincest episode. And then they looked at each other and went, oh, my God, we can't both be happy at the same time. Let's kill each other. But I just had this vision of, you know, when Dean does come out and you've got Crowley and Sam and Cass there, and then on the other side of the screen you've got fandom. It's like everyone loves Dean Winchester.
Yeah.
It's
like – I saw you tweeting that.
Yeah. I just had this moment of seeing, you know, you've got Sam, Cass and Crowley and Kane to some extent.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about the Dean and that love, and it's not a coincidence that, you know, fandom in a way, and yes, I mean, there are Cass girls and Sam girls. I'm not saying everyone loves Dean above everyone else, but there's this feeling that Dean is at the centre of things, which is also a subtle fuck you to the myth arc for Dean people who still keep annoying me. But it was just this reflection of the show and the fandom of just in that moment, it was just like, we all want to tell you that we love Dean the most.
We all want a part of Dean Winchester.
And if you don't, well, maybe you turn into Crowley. and that's because you've got mummy issues. yeah, that's half a fandom as well. We'll be back in a month probably with all about that. Be kind to each other, fandom. Leave us a message and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye. You've been listening to the Women of Letters podcast. If you'd like to contact us, our email is wolspn@gmail.com. You can follow Amy on Twitter @AmyInSydney and Jules @SuperWiki.